Good morning and welcome back to the Weekly Pulse podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder, the founder of the Morning Pulse and your host for the next 60 plus minutes as we go around the globe to discuss the issues related to retirement, the markets, technology, personal finance, so much more. We've got another great show for you this week. Glad you came back, or if you're new, glad you found us. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of kick things off as we always do and look at the latest social media trends, and that means we're going to talk to senior financial services editor from LinkedIn, Mr. Devin Banerjee, CFA. Hey Devin, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I should also add that you are the author, curator of the This Week in Finance newsletter, which comes out every Friday on LinkedIn, right?
Friday. That's right. Yeah, it's a newsletter. It has about 20,000 subscribers right now. But yeah, it's a wrap-up of the most interesting, trending conversations among finance professionals on LinkedIn each week. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, it's a great piece. I know I follow it because I follow you, and I think more people should definitely. I'm surprised you don't have 650 million people, but you're working on that. So
slowly.
Yeah, slowly, but it'll pick up. It always does. So, Devin, what's top of mind this week for you and your colleagues at LinkedIn?
Yeah, so speaking about some of those trending items, some of the most interesting ones in finance and workplace issues include this great Reuters analysis that we featured about index funds. So we've all heard about the absolute, you know, rapid, massive growth of index fund assets in the U.S. and around the world. Reuters looked at how these index funds are voting their proxies. So, you know, as you know, index funds hold shares of many companies around the world, probably all equities around the world, if you look at all index funds. And they have the opportunity to vote on issues like management changes, compensation, et cetera. And what Reuters found is that actually the largest index funds are basically either intentionally or unintentionally rewarding bad actors. So among the three largest index fund providers, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, Reuters found that they're siding with management of the 300 worst performing companies about 84% to 93% of the time. That was during the time frame of 2018.
Interesting.
So Reuters goes through a couple examples. You know, one, the CEO of PG&E, you know, a company that has totally taken a hit after those potential liabilities tied to the California wildfires. The company is on the brink of bankruptcy. The stock is in the tank. All of those index fund providers supported doubling the pay of that CEO, for example. So a lot of the time, as I said, this isn't so really intentional. I mean, it's just they're voting with the status quo. These companies do have to operate or try to operate on a very low-cost basis in order to offer low-cost funds. And so they're not funding research teams to look at all of the equities the funds are invested in and determining how to vote proxies. Some other experts came out and pointed out some other drivers behind this. For example, you know, these funds lack, by definition, they lack a financial incentive to outperform, you know, market indices. A lot of the times they're just tracking indices, and so voting with the status quo just makes sense. And then some people more cynical said, look, a lot of these index fund providers are all about acquiring new customers, and some of these big companies in which they're invested are offering these index fund providers products, the funds, to employees, for example, in retirement plans. And so there's some incentive there to not ruffle feathers very much. So just a fascinating look. It's a long deep dive by Reuters into how these big funds that all of us are, or most of us are invested in, whether we know it or not, a lot of times through our retirement plans, you know, deep dive into how they vote on big company issues.
Yeah, it's a lot of I mean, just thinking it through, and there's probably so many different machinations to this, but the unintended consequences, right? You get the intended consequence of low cost, right? If you're talking about State Street or BlackRock or Vanguard, low cost, you get them in a retirement plan, you get them in your personal savings, you're getting that low cost, it's benefiting you. But the unintended consequence, as you said, is in the case of PG&E and some of these others where you may not be on the other side of a potential proxy vote. I mean, I can tell you when I worked in, I was a record keeper, as you know, and one of the things that we had to do was handle proxy votes. And oftentimes, there would be company stock. This is before ATRA and some of the Dodd amendment, the Dodd's amendment stuff and all the things that went down with that. But you'd have to get proxy votes, and a lot of people just we'd send that proxy and you never get a response. I think there's a lot of apathy, generally speaking, and I think there's a little, I think people can be cynical there because why would you want to ruffle feathers? I mean, if they're potential clients, I mean, money follows money, unfortunately.
And also among individuals, I think I shared with you on the pod a couple of months ago. I mean, some of my friends who I talk with about our investing don't even, some of them don't even know they have the opportunity to vote in shareholder votes. Others feel, what's my one vote going to mean or count for anything? And so there seems to be a bit of an education gap as well in the proxy voting space. But yeah, interesting. We'll see if these big index fund providers get any pressure or anything. But yeah, it remains to be seen.
Well, it's also, people use that same logic when voting for president or Congress. I mean, if everyone had that, everyone stayed home, we wouldn't have a president, or you just had the status quo. I mean, do you, I think it's part of being a shareholder, a share owner of a mutual fund, a share, you can't talk out of both sides of your mouth. If you want change, then you have to advocate for it, whether it's voting at the ballot box or voting in the proxy. And you can still lose, but still vote your point of view. It doesn't mean you're going to win every election, but I've seen lots of people do that, and it's another piece of mail you get because a lot of it, although some of it is electronic now, but a lot of it still goes out through snail mail.
Absolutely. I was just going to put out one more
Sure,
story
I've
that
got about two
really,
minutes.
one story that I was kind of surprised took off on the platform, but it's about what happens to jobs after a private equity fund acquires companies. And even though this is a space I've covered for a long time, I thought it wouldn't have mass appeal. But I think this massive rise of the private markets and private funding and private equity takeover activity has really gotten this industry on the radar of everyday Americans. And so we see a lot of kind of advocacy organizations or research firms with kind of different biases come out over time and talk about, job losses or job gains or productivity, this and that, after private equity buyouts. But there's a new report from these six really well-known researchers, including Josh Lerner at Harvard, who's probably one of the most reputable private equity researchers, really digging into what happens to jobs after a private equity buyout. What they found on aggregate is that on average, about 4.5% of a company's jobs are lost in the first 2 years after a buyout. Worker pay also usually slumps about 1.7%, but productivity actually soars about 8% a year after a buyout. So in a way, this is what you would hear, or part of what you would hear from a private equity fund when it's making its argument, which is that it's taking, badly run or sometimes bloated companies and making them more efficient and more productive. And over time, that leads to jobs after those 2 years when jobs might decline. Over time, the company becomes stronger and can hire more down the line. And then the cynics on the other end would say, well, what happens to those people who lose their jobs in the first couple of years? So just a really nice kind of definitive, if you will, piece of research that came out about the effects. And as I said, private capital has totally swelled around the world and here in the US. And so a lot more companies are coming under private equity ownership today.
Yeah, and I would say that private equity is getting an increased allocation in pension funds, endowments, foundations, et cetera. And in fact, there's a movement now afoot, and it has been for a while, to include it in defined contribution plans, which
yep.
is challenging for other technical reasons because the illiquidity that exists for these types of asset classes. But Devin, always a pleasure talking with you. And you know, there's never a perfect solution for everything. And I think what I love about you is you kind of are able to give both sides and let the listener or the reader, in the case of your piece that you put out every week, decide for him or herself where they sit. But there is no perfect this side of the graveyard. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, Devin, we'll see you Monday for Social Media Monday. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Sounds good. Take care, Jeff.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Well, it's tech time, and joining me now is Daniel Klein. He's the Senior Technology and Consumer Products Reporter with The Motley Fool. Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I feel great. Long time no talk. Just kidding. how are things going in West Palm?
Things are good. I've been home. Well, aside from a brief trip to Disney World, I've been home for most of the week. I'll be home for all of next week. And then November, it'll be doing this show from a different place each week.
Will that be work-related or will it be just vacation time for the family?
Some of it is work-related, going to the Money 2020 show out in Las Vegas. Mm. Some of it is personal travel, going to a bat mitzvah. Oh. Some of it is just sort of random travel. I don't like to stay in the same place all that much.
Well, that's good. I'm the same way, too. So I'm real glad you could join us, and I think our listeners really love the fact that you cover tech and consumer products, keep them informed, and actually helps them. It really dovetails nicely to the rest of our conversations during the podcast on retirement and markets and personal finance. So what's top of mind for you this week and the folks at Motley Fool?
So this is kind of a buyer beware, but also, hey, this is good for consumers. So ever since Toys R Us went bankrupt, a new company emerged that owns the name. They own the trademark Toys R Us. They own ToysRUs.com. Mm-hmm. And the media, of course, trumpeted that as, Toys R Us is back, baby!
Yeah.
And the reality is, in the same way that you see Sharper Image products in stores post Sharper Image bankruptcy, this is much more of a branding play. So a company owns Toys R Us. They own all the trademarks. They own Jeffrey. They own... so they literally do and have used him in some marketing. So they're going to open a handful of stores, mm-hmm. but their real business is in licensing their name. So they're going to take ToysRUs.com and make it a toy and review site. So a place you could go to, in theory, get unbiased, good information about toys. That sounds great. Those, if you want to then buy those toys, those orders are going to take you to Target.com. So this is essentially the owners of Toys R Us telling you that this is a branding play, mm-hmm. that any stores they have, even if you go into the store and want to buy something, if they don't have it on the shelf, they're going to place that order for you through a Target. So obviously they're getting a cut of that sale.
Yeah.
This is about maximizing the name Toys R Us and making money from it. In theory, consumers will go to ToysRUs.com. So that again, there's nothing deceptive about it. But sort of ignore the idea that there's going to be a major Toys R Us retail presence again. It wouldn't shock me if you saw the Toys R Us name in Target, sort of the way you might see like a Wine Spectator label giving you a review in a wine store. So they'll perhaps be a credible editorial outlet. They are not going to be any sort of retail player of any significance. So please dismiss whatever you see in the media about that.
So when my niece's birthday is coming up, and my brother's birthday is actually coming up on the 16th, but my niece's birthday is coming up later in the month. You know, would I be able to still go into a brick and mortar, or as you're saying, I have to go to Target, or do I just shop on Amazon like I typically do? No offense.
So,
no offense, Lily.
If you go to ToysRUs.com now, which I just did,
yeah.
You basically see trending toys, reviews. It looks like it's a toy website. But it's all being served by Target. So in theory, you know, maybe you don't know what your 14-year-old niece is up to. You might be able to get some good recommendations, or maybe my son is very into Nerf guns, and one of the top trending toys is a Nerf blaster. So maybe if I wanted to pick out what to buy for him, I'd get a sense of what's there. It's definitely an asset.
Uh-huh.
And there will be a couple of sort of flagship stores in big cities designed to be interactive, more to expose you to toys than to sell you toys. And the idea here is that Toys R Us is a credible brand. It's a differentiator. Target will get the business based on the strength of Toys R Us, and the people that own Toys R Us won't have to figure out how to do two-day shipping and all the logistics that sort of put you out of business in the first place. Admittedly, debt from a leveraged buyout also put them out of business. So this is a way to sort of keep the brand alive, give it some relevance, maybe help parents buy better gifts and toys, and it's a big win for Target.
Yeah, absolutely a big win for Target, because now they're aligning with the Jeffrey the Giraffe. He can, because I don't, as far as I know, Target doesn't have. Does Target even have, other than that Target, do they even have a mascot?
I don't think there is a Target mascot, and I don't think it's out of the question that down the road you see Toys R Us branding in Target. One of the challenges, and I ran a toy store, so I know this market really well. One of the challenges in being a Target or a Walmart or even an Amazon is there's kind of no character to your toy section. It's a collection of toys. There's no one who works there who can tell you anything. If you can superimpose some Toys R Us expertise onto that, you know, and right now this is just a digital deal. It is not an in-store deal. But eventually, if you could sort of make it a store within a store concept, that might make you go to Target over Walmart. It might, you know, allow them to charge a slightly higher price. I know being an independent toy store, one of the very frustrating things that would happen is we would put a lot of work into selling you a $50 or a $75 board game, like a Ticket to Ride or Settlers of Catan. We would do all the education, and then someone would pull it up on Amazon and buy it for $8 cheaper. It's a problem. That's why Barnes & Noble has struggled with toys. They have a very upscale toy selection, competes well with independent toy stores, but there's not a damn person in those stores that knows anything about them, whereas your average independent toy store, and mine was huge, you know, 50,000 square feet and still is huge and very successful. The average one is, you know, a tiny strip mall store, and you can bet the person who owns that store is probably there, and every person who works there is there for passion and not for money. Mm-hmm. So this might give Target, you know, the ability to have at least, you know, a worker can pull up a review, can sort of give you some of this expertise and make it a more personal experience.
Yeah, well, I remember the good old days when I bought my Green Army Men. I think my mother still has them, or maybe she gave them away. I had like hundreds of them, and then going and looking at the Star Wars figures, because I grew up, I'm a little bit older than you are, but I grew up in the Star Wars era like yourself, and I bought those. So that's good news to know, and I guess I better be going out shortly to pick up something for my niece, Lily. So what else is top of mind for you? I know there was another topic you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so
well,
the other thing I want to talk about is there's sort of a bubbling unrest among Lowe's employees. And so Lowe's changed its CEO, didn't like its results, and they've been doing something that I just want to sort of give consumers a heads up, because I like Lowe's over Home Depot, partially because, in my opinion, it has a more accessible workforce. Mm-hmm. And what they've been doing, and there are a lot of articles about this, is they've had some layoffs. And at the same time, they're hiring tens of thousands of people. And they've targeted with layoffs middle management. And by that I mean the salaried person who runs the hardware department is being replaced by someone who's hourly, who oversees the hardware department, but more of the management work is being done digitally. Why is that bad for consumers? It's bad for consumers because you're losing expertise. Forget that it's not fair to workers, and it's something that pretty much every major chain has done at some point.
That sucks.
Yeah, it's so you're taking the expertise out. And again, I hate to pick on Barnes & Noble, but Barnes & Noble last year laid off about 1,000 people. All of the people it laid off were top-level or middle-level managers that were the true product experts, because it's cheaper to have a clerk who rings you out than have a person that can help you decide which book your moody 15-year-old would be more likely to open based on the other things he or she has read. That's a true level of expertise. So the second you give away these workers, the second you get rid of them, you're removing a competitive advantage, and you're giving me all the more reason to just research it on YouTube or the internet and buy it online, or order it wherever is most convenient, or go to a hardware store that's still locally owned or franchised where there's going to be some actual expertise. I'm very intimidated by these stores. I had to go to Lowe's the other day to buy a grate for my grill so the shrimp wouldn't fall in while I was cooking. And I had to psych myself up for it. And the reality is you walk in and you could see the grill department from the door, yeah, and it was right on the shelf. It wasn't hard at all. But sometimes I've needed hardware and I don't know what I'm doing. I need someone to help me not point in a vague direction or not assume I know all the steps that go into hanging drywall or replacing my doorknob or whatever it is. And I do worry as a consumer and as an investor, though I don't own shares, Lowe's is sort of making those moves where you're sacrificing long-term success to hit quarterly numbers. And I understand, you know, new CEO, a lot of pressure, you know, got to cut numbers, got to cut. But people matter and expertise matters. So as a consumer, this is an area where you speak up. If you go to your Lowe's and you can't get help, write a letter to corporate, speak to the manager. And I understand not wanting to pay big salaries, but these are very successful stores and a very profitable company that doesn't need to be doing this just so it can show 7% growth instead of 5% growth or whatever the actual numbers are.
Yeah, I got to tell you, across not only this industry, that industry, but all other industries, I mean, service is hard to come by. I mean, I've had some issues this week with something online and just going back and forth with people and explaining over and over again what I'm looking for. And I'm very tech savvy compared to the average person, but just it's a frustration. And when you don't know, because you can't be an expert in everything, when you don't know, it's really hard to be satisfied. And that's why, you know, our conversation, I think last week on the show on BRNAM, or maybe it was the prior week, about robo advisors. I think people, you know, kind of taking it back to that for a second, I think they have a purpose, but I think people want to be able to touch and feel and ask a human being questions, because just setting it and forgetting it isn't going to necessarily lead you to success. And the same thing with Lowe's, just going out there and saying, I need a shrimp grill or a shrimp catch for my grill. Where do you find that? You got to find someone who has expertise. You may not be a grill meister in that regard.
Yeah. And so I'll give an example, because I'm willing to pay more for service when I don't understand something.
Yep, absolutely.
I bought a DrinkWorks. It's a Keurig product that works kind of like your K-Cup machine, but the pods make alcoholic beverages. And I got it because we have a vacation home. We entertain there. It's kind of an expensive drink, but you know, for $4 essentially per pod, I could have you over and you have a gin and tonic. I have a rum and coke. I don't have to have all the different ingredients for those are two pretty simple drinks, but for more complicated drinks. So I got this thing out of the box and I went through the sequence and it was all pretty easy and none of it worked. And it was 10 o'clock at night. And well, I wanted a drink and I was all excited to play with my new toy. And I called customer service. And within 90 seconds, I had a person on the phone who not only listened to my problem, but took me through the steps, got the item reset, got it so it was working, or at least that particular problem was solved. I actually did hang up the phone or end the call before realizing that I had only solved the problem of it intaking water, not spitting out a finished beverage. But it was excellent concierge service that they followed up with in an email. In that email, it gave me the instructions to what if you're still having problems? Well, the next time I'm at that house, the first thing I'm going to do is call up and say, here's what your guy did. It got me to this point. But then when I went to make an actual drink, it only spit out the syrup. It didn't mix it with the chilled water. And so obviously I didn't have a viable drink. But that was top tier service. And hey, I paid. This was not a cheap device, $399, something like that. But I'm willing to do that. If Lowe's told me that I could spend $10 a month and every time I walked in, there would be a person who took me through what I needed, mm-hmm, I would do that at times of my life where I'm involved in construction. It's very intimidating. I'm doing some work at that house, or a friend of mine is doing some work. And while he's doing the work, I'm going to be the guy who runs to Lowe's to get the stuff he needs. And he knows enough that I don't know what I'm doing to give me explicit instructions as to where they are, what to look for, what to ask for. And that's something as a consumer that has a value. A lot of small businesses survive, but a big business can offer that. You know, if you walk into a Target and grab an employee, there's a pretty decent chance that person's going to help you and help you pretty well. Yep. So I don't see why Lowe's, you know, can't do that and still maintain its bottom line.
Yeah, well said, Dan. And you can catch Dan not only his own writing for The Motley Fool, but also he'll be coming up on Tuesday. It's our Tech Tuesday on BRN AM. Look for him to talk about all things tech and consumer products. Dan, always a pleasure. Hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we will talk to you soon, my friend.
Thanks for having me. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Welcome back. We're going to shift gears, talk a little markets. Joining me on the line, he is the lead anchor for the TD Ameritrade Network, and you see him on Morning Trade Live and Markets on the Close. It is Oliver J. Rennick. Hey, Ollie, how are you?
Yo, what up, Jeff? Doing pretty well. Busy Friday.
Yeah, it is a busy Friday. I'm glad we could check in with you. So, busy week this week. Lots going on. What do you? Can you break it down for us in something that even I would understand?
Sure. This is a market that's obviously very excited about the potential for some kind of truce or de-escalation of the U.S.-China tension. That's pretty much what it boils down to. There's a lot happening in the background still that is worth a mention, which is Fed expectations, more activity on the balance sheet as the Fed tries to provide a little bit of a grease to some of the short-term bond markets. But for the most part, really, everything here does seem to hinge on trade negotiations in terms of sentiment and in terms of a sort of market froth and sentiment. I kind of use those as being the real important aspects in regards to trade as opposed to the real earnings front, because we still don't really have a ton of clear evidence as to what to expect in the economy and by transition corporate earnings. If there is trade truce, trade deal, anything along those lines, the big question right now is how much of the economic slowness here in the U.S. has been a result of trade tariffs, trade policy, and how much is just sort of an unavoidable kind of slowdown that the rest of the world is experiencing, and we eventually are as well. We don't have a lot of clear answers to that. It'll only be obvious in retrospect, but it yeah. definitely doesn't hurt to get some kind of resolution, and that's what markets are hoping for as we wind up the week.
Yeah, I bet you had a wide range of opinions, some bullish, some bear, as to whether or not mm-hmm. this was going to quell that feeling.
Exactly. It's very true. And really, you can take, 10 of the smartest economists or strategists that you know, and they're probably split down the middle right now. And both cases seem totally reasonable. The bears seem very reasonable. The bulls seem very reasonable. That's because it is hard to really find clarity in this. On the one hand, you have an overall economic malaise that is probably not going to do a 180 unless there's really, really a truly groundbreaking agreement between, the two biggest economies in the world. I mean, let's not downplay it. This tariff situation has definitely weighed on sentiment. Very logically, there's good logical support for why it might be behind a slowdown in business capex in the U.S., why it might be behind CEO confidence eroding a little bit, but we still don't really know. So as far as the stock market's concerned, it's rallying on expectations that we will at least have a some kind of truce or delay in the next round of tariffs. But really what that's doing is just moving stock prices up. Earnings expectations have not moved up, and you wouldn't expect them to turn around on a dime. So there's definitely some tension even in a positive outcome for markets, but in the short term, for those looking at the big picture, it's hard to envision a slowdown or rather a de-escalation of U.S.-China tensions as anything but positive. That's really the takeaway.
Yeah. Oliver, what about bonds? I know you wrote for many years at the Bond Buyer, and I know so mm-hmm. bonds are near and dear to your heart, but what about what about debt? How do you look at debt? Or what? I mean, I know it's not like the sexiest topic, but what are you hearing about debt on your programs?
Sure. Well, actually, it's funny you mentioned bonds because our coverage has really been lately very much focused on the bond market in terms of treasuries, because when you look at the corporate bond market, it really appears that everything is calm and comfortable. yield spreads between corporate bonds and the treasury market are very narrow by historical standards, but you also have very, very low 10-year yields. So the comparison is a low bar, basically. So one, it means that some indebted companies might be more fragile than we think because the tools sort of that most people look to, credit spreads, are naturally kind of contained. We had a case, a pretty a compelling case on that front made by a portfolio manager on our program this week. And I think it's a really interesting one because right now corporate bonds don't reflect the type of risk that you would expect with the level of concerns that the U.S. economy and the rest of the world are kind of going through. So there's that. And on the other side, just from a sort of bond market perspective, not so much a debt perspective, but from a bond market perspective, the 10-year treasury is extremely volatile right now. It's actually more volatile by some measurements than the equity market. So there's definitely something happening in bonds that is going to be super important because if bonds do anything basically but go up, and right now they're getting very, very volatile as they sell off from highs. If they do anything, then go up and yields go down, there's going to be a lot of people who have to rethink their positions because most investors ascribe to a very strong consensus right now that the economy is slowing, central banks will keep cutting, and bond yields will only go down. And that hasn't really been the case now for over a month. So we're starting to question that in a very big way.
Yeah, and if I'm a pension plan looking to offload my debt, I mean, all these have impacts to what we talked about early in the week around companies like General Electric. If you have a pension liability, if you've got a high mm-hmm. weighted allocation to debt, what is that going to be worth? What does it mean in terms of the actuarial valuation? All those kind of things. So, I mean, I guess it's just more wait and see, but it's fun kind of watching. I would expect for you to see how this all kind of unfolds every day. It's kind of like your own little soap opera, right?
Hey, it is, and the guy in charge definitely knows how to make good TV, and that, I'm talking about the president there with all the teasing of meetings and timing and tweets. So it's pretty wild. The market is moving very, very sharply on things that it usually, you know, is a little bit more calm about. So it's definitely fun times.
Well, I can only imagine what it's like in the control room for you and the team. But obviously you're doing something right because you're busy week. You do amazing, amazing work. Oliver, thank you so much for joining
us, Jeff.
And we will talk to you all again next week.
All right, you got a nice hit here on the network this week, by the
Thanks.
Way. Good job.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, Jeff. All right, bye.
Welcome back, and now we're going to shift gears. You know, it's open enrollment season, and I couldn't think of anyone better to talk about the various options than Mari Backman. She is a personal finance reporter with The Motley Fool. Hi, Mari. How are you?
Doing great. How are you, Jeff?
It's great to talk to you. Great appearance on the show on BRNAM. You were awesome and talked about a lot of great important issues. And open enrollment seems to be another really important issue to Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. And to clarify, we are talking about open enrollment at work. We're not
yes.
talking about Medicare's open enrollment. That's a separate thing. But for all of you folks who are employees who are entitled to workplace benefits, we're getting into that season where you're probably going to be getting some sort of package sent home or some sort of email saying, okay, time to choose your benefits for the upcoming year. You'll need to, you know, pick a health plan and some other stuff. You'll need to maybe opt into different fringe benefits like legal plans, pet insurance, and so forth. And you'll probably have an opportunity to sign up for either a flexible spending account or a health savings account. And that's, I think, what we want to talk about today.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are very important, distinctively different vehicles, although they're similar in some regards, correct?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people tend to confuse them or think they're the same thing, and they're really not. So a flexible spending account is probably the more well-utilized option of the two. A flexible spending account lets you put in a certain amount of money. The limit changes every year. Right now, I think it's $2,700 for 2019. It may or may not go up for next year. And that money can be used to pay for qualified medical expenses like the copays you pay when you visit your doctor or when you, you know, pick up medications or certain, you know, medical supplies and equipment are, you know, are eligible when you buy eyeglasses. And flexible spending accounts are great because the money that you put in there goes in pre-tax, so that you put in $1,000 into that account, that's $1,000 the IRS isn't taxing you on. And since you're using it for things you're going to have to purchase anyway, it makes sense. The problem with FSAs is that if you don't deplete your plan balance by the end of the year, mm-hmm. you lose the money that's in there. So you have to be a little careful when you decide what to put into an FSA. You don't want to just necessarily say, oh, well, if the max is $2,700, I'll put in all $2,700 because I get that tax break. Well, yeah, that's only good if you rack up $2,700 worth of expenses. If you don't, you know, you risk forfeiting that money, which you don't want
to
do.
Yeah, so it's important, I gather, to understand what your expenses have been in the past. Certainly, you can't prognosticate whether or not you're going to have a major medical event, but you can kind of get – it's kind of like when you look at your, you know how you, when you buy electrical service through like a utility, and you can smooth out your payment. It's similar to that, where you can look at your past history and kind of figure out what your expenses are going to be.
Exactly. The past year or two, you know, if you look at your bills from the medical bills for the past year or two, that's probably your best indicator. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing about FSAs is that, you know, you need to spend down your plan balance within a certain year, but you don't necessarily need to use the things you buy that year. So what that means is, you know, if you're coming up toward the end of the year and you've got an extra $300 sitting in your FSA, you can use it to, you know, renew your contact lenses for another year and just buy another year's worth of contact lenses. The IRS isn't going to come and check and see, you know, what year you wore those lenses during. Or you can, you know, you can renew like a bulk, you know, prescription. Some people buy like 90-day supplies of medications. You know, you can do that at the very end of the year. So there is a little wiggle room. And some plans usually do give you a little bit of flexibility where you get a small grace period to use your funds up. But in general, the thing with an FSA is you want to be accurate in what you put in, because you only get a year to use it up. And that's actually a major distinction between FSAs and HSAs. So let's go to HSAs, okay, because these are great. An HSA is a health savings account. Not everyone qualifies. To be eligible for an HSA, you need to be on a high deductible health insurance plan. The definition of high deductible changes from year to year. Right now it's $1,350 or more if you mm-hmm. have coverage for yourself only. It's $2,700 or more as a deductible if you have coverage at the family level. But if you do – and there's some other criteria you'll need to make to qualify as well. But if you qualify for an HSA, the money that goes into that account does not have to be used up by a certain point in time. It actually doesn't expire. In fact, the whole point of an HSA – is to actually put in more money than you think you're going to use in a given year. And the reason is you're allowed to actually invest whatever funds you're not using and then carry that money forward into the future, ideally all the way into retirement when income can be limited and healthcare costs can skyrocket. Like flexible spending accounts, HSAs are tax advantaged. The money that you put in goes in tax-free. So if you put $1,000 into an HSA, again, that's $1,000 you're not being taxed on. But the other cool thing is that the gains that you earn on your investments in that account are also tax-free.
Right.
And then withdrawals are tax-free, provided they're used for qualified medical expenses as well.
It sounds very similar to almost like a 401k or a 403b, where you're putting money away in the – it's generally tax-deferred, although you can have some after-tax money in a 401k or 403b or 457 plan. But let's put that aside. It sounds like that is a nice option to have. But just explain, with a high-deductible health plan, you have a higher deductible, which means the premia that you're paying, so what you're paying per paycheck is a little bit lower versus a traditional healthcare plan. Is that correct?
Usually that's how it works. Usually the higher the deductible, the lower the premium. And so, yeah, the downside of a high deductible is that that's the amount you need to come up with out of pocket before your insurer picks up the cost of your healthcare services.
Right.
So if you've got a $1,350 deductible, you will need to spend that much of your own money before you just, you know, go and, you know, have a medical appointment and pay your copay. Although there's sometimes an exception if you're just doing like an annual physical or well visit. Certain things are are, you know, exempt from the deductible. But for the most part, that's what you're looking at. A lot of people who are on high deductible health plans are on them because they have no choice. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, but sometimes. But the silver lining is then that you are eligible for an HSA. Another great thing, you know, you likened HSAs to 401ks. Another similarity is that, you know, with a 401k, you'll often contribute money and then your employer will match what you put into that 401k to a certain degree. Some employers do put money into HSAs on their employees' behalf.
Yep.
It doesn't tend to be a matching system like the 401k, but you will sometimes get free money into that HSA. Now, that contribution counts toward your annual limit, which right now for the current year, it's $3,500 mm-hmm. as an individual or $7,000 as a family, and it's actually going up a little bit for 2020. The other thing is that if you're 55 or older, you can contribute an additional $1,000 on top of whichever limit you qualify for. It's sort of considered a catch-up, just like you can make catch-ups in your IRA and 401k. And again, we're using that terminology because even though you can use an HSA from year to year, you're not, you know, limited. You don't have to wait till you're a certain age to withdraw funds from that account. They really are becoming increasingly regarded as a viable retirement savings tool.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And we know through your writing and other research that the cost of healthcare and retirement is going to be extraordinarily high. I think someone estimated it's close to $300,000 in today's dollars for a couple. You can allocate some of your money. You know, I think what's interesting about what you're describing and how you're kind of we're tying it back to the 401k and to retirement is that you've got these different pockets of money, but they're all kind of moving in some ways in sync with one another. The FSA does get wiped away at the end of each year, but does allow you to save, put money towards pre-tax. The HSA continues to be, you know, doesn't go get wiped away, but it is another vehicle that I think I would imagine, Maury, that a lot of people aren't. I mean, the reason why we're doing this segment is because it's open enrollment, and maybe there's some people out there who may not really know that this exists or haven't looked that detailed into their benefits package or their summary plan description, et cetera.
Right. Right. Exactly. And it's something to keep in mind if you do have the option to choose between a high deductible health insurance plan or not. Just something to know is that if you do go with the high deductible option to lower your premium costs, another benefit is that you then, if your deductible is high enough, you then become eligible for an HSA, and there's a lot of savings and a lot of good opportunity involved there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you got to do the math. It's not a lot of the open enrollment tools now are no longer forms that you actually open enroll online. Really good to sit down as a family. As a familial unit and potentially with an advisor to figure out what is the best situation for you. Because it can change year to year. If you have an event where you get married and now you have someone that's dependent on you, whose health care do you go on? What is their health history, right? All those things kind of play into this. If you have children, what is their health
yeah.
history? Are they 1, 3, 5, 10? Kids are younger, they typically get pick up things and get colds and things like that.
Oh yeah, yep.
And you mm-hmm. may know this firsthand, Maury. So
yeah, exactly. So having three young kids myself, I can tell you they are germ magnets.
Yeah.
So, a lot to be discussed.
A lot to be wrestled with and thought through. And so now's the time to do that, Maury. I can say it's a pleasure talking with you. It was great seeing you on the show earlier this week and very insightful. Hope people pick up on this and. Hope everyone has a really good open enrollment. Great talking with you this week. Have a good weekend.
You too, Jeff. Stay healthy, everyone. Take care.
Bye. Welcome back, everyone. And I'm going to shift gears, talk a little real estate. And who better to talk real estate with than the real estate reporter for MarketWatch, Mr. Jacob Passy. JP, how are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm doing okay. It's tending to get a little cooler here in the Northeast, as you know, in New York. And I like the fall weather, but, what can I say? It's getting a little cold. I hate cold weather, especially when I have no hair.
Yeah, I grew up in Florida, so I very much don't like the cold. So yeah, well, I'll be bundling up for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I guess we're both kind of screwed in that regard. But a lot going on, I understand, in the real estate market. So, you know, who better than the check-in with you? What can you tell us this week? What, any big deals, any big news that you want to share?
Yeah. So one big thing that happened this week was the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, he signed a new law that institutes a statewide rent control policy across the entire state of California. Mm. So that makes California just the second state in the country that has a statewide cap on rent increases. And I did a story kind of looking into this because on the surface, that sounds like a great thing. And in a lot of ways, it is, obviously. You know, it's great for people that they won't have to, you know, face the doubling. You know, sometimes people we're seeing their rents double, especially in places like San Francisco, Los Angeles, you know, some of these really competitive markets. I know the situation was very dicey, but I did a story looking into, you know, kind of some of the unintended consequences that rent control can have as a policy, and looking into, you know, the ways in which it's not really the, you know, foolproof tool that, you know, lawmakers, you know, especially progressive lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers may want it to be. So, you know, for starters, so Oregon was the first state to pass a law like this in the country. They did so earlier this year. And there was a report that showed that when they passed the rent control policy, rent increases, a lot of people actually saw their rents go up almost immediately in the state because basically landlords were trying to get ahead of the law. So California lawmakers were smart, and they actually made it retroactive, their law, so to prevent landlords from doing that. So they basically said, you know, starting from this past March, moving forward, rent increases can only be capped to at 5% plus inflation each year until 2030. So that was a good thing. But just one thing to keep in mind, you know, if your town or state or city institutes a new rent control policy, you might actually see rents go up in the short term before if there's a lag time between when the law is signed and when it goes into effect. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But there's been lots of studies also that have shown that rent control as a policy can make housing more expensive. The jury is a little bit out on that. There was a recent study that actually showed that that wasn't true. So there's nothing definitive yet.
Yeah.
But there's a few different reasons, and you know, one being that you know, especially when it's you know, in some cities, the rent control policy will be such that, you know, it only applies to buildings built before, you know, say like 1995 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is, you know, what that ends up happening in a lot of cities is, you know, people who live in, you know, an apartment building built before 1995 are reticent to move ever, so they just, you know, stay put. So that could, you know, effectively take an apartment off the market for, you know, decades. Years. And then meanwhile, the you know, buildings that aren't covered by whatever the rent control policy is grow more expensive because there's more competition for those units since the units covered by the policy don't come on the market as readily. So that's one issue. Another issue is that, you know, and this is kind of what the industry will say is, you know, they say that, you know, these laws disincentivize being a landlord. And so that can, you know, have a, you know, ripple effect where it can lead to, you know, a slowdown in construction of new apartment buildings and things like that. Or, you know, landlords may say, you know, well, if I can't, you know, if the landlord's having trouble, you know, making ends meet financially and now, you know, can't raise the rent as much as they would like to, you know, they may turn around and decide to, you know, sell the property and privatize it or, you know, sell it to owner occupants,
right.
You know, take it off the rental market. So there's various ways in which, you know, rent control can, you know, have an adverse effect. And what a lot of people, you know, were kind of saying, a lot of people who are opposed to this law in California were saying was, you know, the solution in a state like California, and really any state across the country, isn't necessarily, you know, capping rent increases as much as it is, you know, incentivizing the construction of new apartment buildings.
Right.
You know, right now, we've talked about this week after week, you know, right now the situation that we're in, the reason prices are going up for, you know, rental units and you know, homes alike is because there's just not a lot out on the market in many parts of the country. So, you know, capping rent increases, may be a solution to one extent. It may be, an interim solution, and it certainly, there's certainly an extent to which it could be part of a broader, plan. But mm-hmm. that alone isn't going to solve, the genesis of why rents are going up so much, which isn't necessarily landlords looking to gouge their tenants as much as it is, the fact, simple, laws of economics, the limited supply makes things more expensive.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, the law in California, so let me back up. So rent control, is that more of a urban, or do you see rent control in suburban or more rural areas? I would think it'd be more urban, but California, Palo Alto and Silicon Valley, I guess those are urban-esque, but not how I view a big city.
It's definitely more of a thing that you see in urban areas. Mm-hmm. California's law notably does not apply to single-family homes, so single-family rentals, which, as you're kind of pointing out, in rural areas, you're probably less likely to see apartment buildings
right.
and more likely to see single-family rentals, and those are not covered by this law. So it's only actually estimated that the law will only cover around 8 million of the 17 million people who rent in California. So less than half of California renters are actually going to probably benefit from the law. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask you. So you mentioned that Oregon is another state that passed this. Do you see this? California, obviously the fifth largest economy in the world, the largest state in population in the country. Do you see this kind of meandering its way across the country into other states, or is it really just here in the more populous areas? Just best guess. Not going to hold you to it. Just best guess.
I don't anticipate this being a particularly popular policy for a number mm-hmm. of reasons. One, as it stands right now, so these are only two states that have statewide rent control policies. And in fact, most states actually have laws that actively prevent cities from creating their own rent control mandates. So according to the National Multifamily Housing Council, which is a trade group that
yep.
represents, apartment building owners, I think it's like over 30 states have state laws that actually preempt rent control, meaning that, for instance, Washington is one of these states. So in Washington, Seattle can't turn around and say, we're going to create a rent control policy for Seattle. The state law actually bans that.
Right.
So in most states, that's the law that's in effect, and as a result, you're probably unlikely to see any statewide policy come to fruition. That being said, there are obviously cities across the country, and it is more of an urban thing. So,
mm-hmm.
A lot of cities in California already had rent control policies. New York, interestingly, has a law. We don't have a statewide rent control policy in New York, but the state has a law that explicitly allows for cities to establish their own rent control policies, which is a little unusual. There's not that many states that have a law like that.
Right.
And that applies to any town nationwide or statewide. So, it's quite popular here in New York. New Jersey is another state like that. So in these kind of more, especially on the, in the kind of mid-Atlantic region, you see a number of cities that have that. There are states like like Pennsylvania and Nevada where there's no state law that allows for rent control, and then there's also no state law that prohibits it. So,
right, so
it's kind of in a weird gray zone legally. That all being said, just by the sheer fact that, a lot of these states, not only would it take creating a law, but it would also take, basically overturning existing law that bans rent control. I think that's just a hurdle that would be difficult to cross in many states. But, this is in places like Seattle, I have friends who live out in Seattle and they've, had to move. They have commutes of, an hour and a half, 2 hours now, because that's how far out you sometimes have to move in some of these really popular cities to find an affordable place to live.
Absolutely.
So, I think there is certainly a groundswell for affordable housing initiatives, but it'll remain to be seen whether rent control will be one of them.
I've got about 45 seconds left, Jacob. Last question. In your research and discussions with some of these interest various interest groups on all sides of the issue. How much do they think that environmental, like if you don't have a glut and you have a limited number of properties that are available for rent or for buying, you know, and which it seems to be the case in San Francisco, how much does environmental law, which is, you know, very high, there's a lot of regulations in California that differ in other parts of the country, does that come into play? Did you get any feedback there about
you mean
some
in
of
terms
those...
of making it difficult to build home?
Yes,
build apartment
yes,
buildings?
To be, create more supply.
Yeah.
Did that come up at all?
I'm sure it comes up to some extent. I think, you know, what's going on here is actually more just kind of than the NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard kind of sentiment. You know, I think everyone on paper, you know, agrees that we need more housing and more apartment buildings will help everyone and whatnot, make things affordable for everyone. But then when someone finds out that, you know, city planners are planning on zoning an affordable housing complex in your neighborhood, then that's when people go up in arms with, you know, oh, well, it'll be an eyesore, it'll drive down our property values, even though a lot of that's not actually true. So that's probably the bigger hurdle is, you know, kind of in theory, everyone is for, you know, affordable housing, but in practice, a lot of people, you'll see a lot of people rise up against it once it's, you know, actually being planned for their area, which makes it especially challenging because, you know, from, you know, an environmental perspective, especially when it comes to building multifamily, you know, apartment buildings and condos, you know, that's good from an environmental perspective if you can, you know, build them near transit and things like that and orient people away from driving. You know, the more, you know, more densely, you know, densely inhabited cities can be more beneficial in a way because then we're not spreading out further and further into the suburbs and, you know, tearing down forests to build new, you know, gated communities and things like that.
Absolutely. Well, Jacob, always a pleasure talking to you. Very interesting. And, you know, those unintended consequences, you just never see them, right? I mean, that's just the, you know, the travails of being an economist. You just never see those unintended consequences until they hit you right in the smack in the mouth.
And it'll be interesting to see if California proves everyone wrong, and if, you know, if prices actually do come down as a result, I think that'll be, you know, a lesson, and that might spur some other states to consider this.
Absolutely. Jacob Passy, always a pleasure talking with you. Have a great rest of the weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
You too. Take care.
Thanks, bud. Welcome back, and we're going to wrap up our show, as we always do, with a talk with the Legal Eagles. Joining me on the line from a remote location, David Levine, Kevin Walsh, both are principals with the Groom Law Group. Gentlemen, how are you today?
We're doing well, Jeff. Thanks for having us on. We're actually in the same location in Boston. We've been at a conference on blockchain, which has been pretty interesting, although I don't think that's one of our topics for today.
Well, maybe. You never know. David, what's top of mind for you and the Eagles this week?
Top of mind for us, while blockchain is on the mind and maybe for another week, today's top of mind is two different topics. Last night, this being Thursday, breaking news, we get some proposed regulations in California on privacy. So what does that mean for us on the CCPA? The second thing that's on our list right now, of course, is there's been a lot of news the last week about the SEC looking into the governmental space, 403B, 457 plans. What's going on there? The question is this feel like DOL? Is it something different? Or what does this mean for the SEC and the retirement universe? Kevin, we're going to play the lottery. Which one do you want to go with first?
Well, thanks, David. I was hoping to talk a little about the executive orders, but I think we'll save that for another week. This is a week that we have so much to talk about that we can't hit everything. But so what I'm going to focus on is the SEC. And kind of in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of discussion about who's going to be the primary regulator across retirement. And DOL tried to be the primary regulator with their fiduciary rule, where they were going to regulate the rollover space, they were going to regulate kind of outside of the pure ERISA plans. And then in 2016, we began to get signals that the SEC wanted to regulate kind of the IRA space, and they wanted to cover rollovers. And then there's been a lot of talk recently about harmonization. So what we're beginning to see now is some indications of, you know, where the line drawing is going to be between DOL and SEC. And by this, I mean, when we start looking at kind of the what DOL's been doing in terms of looking at fees for plans, they've been doing investigations inside the ERISA universe, but the area outside of the ERISA universe, so a lot of 403Bs and 457s, have traditionally been left to kind of plaintiff firms. to regulate in the fee space. Just last week, the SEC started, or in September, and just last week they became public. The SEC started sending out notices to TPAs for 403B plans and 457 plans, asking them about their fees, asking about their relationships, and asking them about how they're getting comp for distribution. This is going to be an area to watch because it signals that the line between DOL-covered plan and SEC-covered plan is becoming clearer, but it's also signaling that you've got a regulator who's willing to investigate kind of on both sides. So you don't dodge federal regulation simply because you're not a DOL-covered plan. David?
I agree completely. I agree completely at this point. And I think, Jeff, I think a key takeaway is let's talk about what it means for our different groups here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Group number one, you know, in the governmental space, what does this mean? Well, it depends what state you're in. For instance, in places like states like California, states like Texas, those are states where there's different rules about 403B and sometimes 457 providers, and there's different state requirements. How are people looking at those? People have worked hard to comply, but if you're a service provider, what's your relationships? All the things you went through with 408B2 and fee disclosure and 404A5, what are you doing there? We'll see what the SEC digs into, but certainly there's been a lot of talk in recent years, and even some have gone to the SEC there where they've gotten letters from the SEC talking about, well, how do you do fee disclosure? How do you do this? And this may be, as Kevin says, bringing things together, separate and distinct.
And David, do you mind if I say one more thing about before we pivot to CCPA?
Actually, I wasn't done yet, but, you know, I can't ever I can't even stop you, Kevin, in the first place. I have a hunch we're not going to make it to CCPA today. So go ahead, and then I'll do a little more, and maybe we'll save CCPA for next week.
So my hunch here is that, I mean, when we think about what the SEC has been doing lately, particularly in kind of the new rules they've put out for registered investment advisors, and then kind of the initiative they've had over 12b1 fees, which started off with a requesting for self-reporting of violations, now has moved to an investigatory phase, that this movement to look at plans is really part of Jay Clayton and the SEC's push for more transparency around fees, and the idea that retirement savers and retail investors can protect themselves, but only if there's more transparency than we're seeing in the market today.
All right, Kevin, I love what you say, but I'm going to bring it down to earth for the plan sponsors a little more on top of that, because you're absolutely right. But for the plan sponsors, what does that
mean? Did I wonk it up too much?
I don't know. You know, I'm the wonky guy sometimes. I'm fluffy some days, so we can trade off. But but I think for today, you know, I think for the plan sponsors, this is a good highlight. The SEC, like, take a look what they've done in governmental plans and defined benefit plans. They haven't taken a hammer to the plans, the plan sponsors there, but it does highlight the increasing focus. So if you are a sponsor of a 403B, 457 plan, what is your process for understanding what you're paying? People deserve to be paid. Everybody does a job. The question is understanding and why. It doesn't mean the ERISA rules automatically apply, but the SEC, these are securities a lot of the times. Mm. How does the SEC look at this and say, in light of Reg BI and other things, you make a great point that I'm teasing you about wonking it up. I happen to agree. I think that this is a good wake-up moment for all sides in the industry, and many people are well awake already and are focused on this. It's a good moment for those in the industry to really say, if I have a plan or if I'm servicing a plan, how are my disclosures? Is there room for growth? It doesn't mean anything was wrong, but this is a reminder that these plans are under supervision, even if it's a little different than the ERISA world. With that, Jeff, I'm inclined to say we'll pass on CCPA and talk next week.
Awesome. Well, guys, I want to thank you very much.
CCPA, EOs, we've got a whole lot for future weeks, Dave, but I think we've got the next 4 weeks kind of mapped out with all the action this past week.
Hey, Kevin, I thought I was going to be missing participants all the time. What can I say?
Well, guys, I want to say thank you very much. And this looks to be incredibly interesting. We'll look for more of the latest news from you guys. Until next week, you guys have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you all very soon. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Jeff.
Well, folks, that wraps up this episode of the Weekly Pulse podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Time just flies when you're having fun. But at the end of the day, I really feel like I'm informed, and I hope you are as well. Don't forget to tune in to BRNAM. That's our morning show. It's also available online and also through podcasts as well. If you don't want to watch us, you can always listen to us. So until then, until next week, I'm Jeff Snyder. Talk to you soon. Have a great rest of your weekend.